Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Talking US Emily with Dr. Paul and Dr. Stavros. Before we dive in, today's episode is brought to you by the Med Student Mentorship Program, which is a one-of-a-kind mentorship program created by Dr. Stavros and Dr. Paul to help guide medical students through the entire medical school journey. Our goal is to help make your 4 years of medical school go as smoothly as possible and help you become a top-performing student in both the basic and clinical science years. Inside this mentorship program, we're available to all members for support in all areas of med school life. Whether you're struggling to do well in a class and need a study strategy, or you're preparing for the USMLE exams, we're here to help with absolutely everything. Our goal is to help students make a smooth transition into and beyond medical school and minimize the pain and struggles that plague the overwhelming majority of medical students. Back when we were in medical school, we would have given anything to have someone who's been through all of the challenges to reach out to for advice, strategies, and guidance. If you're a medical student and you've ever wondered if the advice you've received from other medical students is the best possible advice for your career, then our mentorship program is for you. We're available daily for support. We provide daily check-ins with students to ensure everyone who needs help can get it. And we do a weekly live seminar tackling a variety of different med school related topics, from how to study in first year to study plans and strategies for all of the USMLE exams, all the way to how to effectively put together your residency application package. We provide training based on our own experiences and also bring in superstar students and physicians every single month to give you access to the best minds in medicine so you can learn from top students and gain insights from the top physicians in their respective fields, something that you simply won't receive anywhere else. Not only do you get a peek inside the minds of top performers, but you'll also be able to ask them any questions you want. No matter where you are in your journey, our mentorship program will give you the tools, strategies, and peace of mind that you need to be able to become the best physician that you could possibly be. Learn more about our exclusive Med Student Mentorship Program by visiting medstudentmentorship.com. Now let's dive into today's episode. Welcome everybody to another episode. Today what we're going to be talking about are basically just the 10 top questions that we've been getting. So over the last few weeks, what we've done is we've gathered questions that students have been asking us, and we sort of just decided, instead of, you know, coming up with our own topic, let's just dive into what you guys want to know. So let's just dive in. We have 10 questions. We have them here, and what we'll do is I will read one off, and then I'll let Dr. Stavros answer, and then I'll put in my two cents, and then he can ask the next question, and then I'll answer, and we'll just go that way. Okay,
sounds great.
All right, question number one. So for most cases I practice, I run out of time. If it happens in the real exam, what should I focus on and what can I leave out?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. Realistically, you can't leave out anything. That's the whole point with the CS exam. You need to be able to prepare yourself the right way. Because what can you leave out? Every case is different. Every scenario is going to be different. You know, you don't have control over the SP, what they're going to provide. Are there going to be issues with sleeping, issues with the ambulation, issues with their occupation? So to pick and choose, say, well, you know, for the next case, I'm going to leave out, you know, a certain part of the component that's going to be vital. You won't know if it's vital or not. So that's the whole point. You know, you have to practice to a point where you're comfortable knowing what you're doing so you can finish the case in under 15 minutes. So you can't really miss, you can't leave anything out realistically.
Yeah, absolutely agree 100%. It's not a feasible approach for the CS to say, I'm weak in this area, so I'm going to figure out what I can eliminate. It'd be like saying, you know, I'm weak in micro, so when it comes to the step one, I'm going to just forget about micro. It won't work, because what happens if you have a micro heavy exam? You're going to fail. Same thing here. If let's say you decide that I'm really, really bad at being empathetic and I just can't do it. It's not in my culture. We came from a really cold family. We weren't empathetic. I'm just going to avoid it. What happens when you have a patient who just lost her spouse and you have to be empathetic and you're not? What happens to the phone call where the kid has febrile seizures and mom and dad are flipping out and you're just sitting there not saying anything? Yeah. That's not going to go well. So you have to absolutely 100% master each component. You have to know what to do from beginning to end. You can't leave anything out. You can't decide I'm going to omit doing this or doing that. It's just not the right approach. This exam is so important for your future. Why would you say, I'm weak somewhere, so I'm just going to skip that part? Instead of saying, I'm weak somewhere, let me figure out where, and then let me get help, or let me just work my butt off to improve those areas so that I can bring everything 100% into the exam. So if that's a question that you've asked, whether it's about the actual encounter or the patient note, just you can't have that mentality. You have to come in 100% across the board, or you're putting yourself in a really, really dire situation, and you're going to be more stressed out because during the exam, you're going to be waiting for those areas that you struggle, and you're going to be worried that they're going to pop up. And if they do, it's going to just cause more and more anxiety. So better to figure out now where you're not strong, work your butt off to get better, and then go into the exam confident. Instead of worrying about, you know, oh, I hope this doesn't come up or that doesn't come up or this type of case doesn't come up. It's not the right approach. And there's so much riding on this that if this is a question you've asked, reach out to myself, Dr. Stavros, one of us, both of us, whatever. Let's figure out what the problem is so that we can guide you moving forward, because you don't want to move forward with any deficiencies in the CS. It's just too important, especially in this day and age.
Well, I'll give you two quick scenarios, because I guarantee people that are listening and are watching us and have these questions. A, if I had two of you in our room here or with Dr. Paul, one case was two differentials, and then it's the same exact chief complaint case like chest pain, but I'm providing you two different differentials. Aren't there going to be different findings? Perhaps the exercise or drug use, alcohol use was actually pertinent in this case. So you can't go ahead and just randomly choose what to ask and what not to ask. Right? And there's one more thing I want to emphasize, because I guarantee there's people out there, doctors and students, they go, well, I can't type that fast, so I'll just leave the room earlier so I can put that extra time on my note. And granted, that's an understandable approach, but again, you have no control of the patient. The patient might be talking a little slower. The patient might have multiple questions at the end of the case. So if you're going to bank on, well, I'm going to leave just earlier, you might leave valuable information on the table, and then you're going to call me up and say, hey, doc, no, I, whatever the case might be, I didn't have a differential. I don't want to hear that, right? That's the whole point. You want to make sure you know the information importantly. That's all.
Yes. Awesome. Simple as it. Awesome. All right. Question number two.
Okay. Let me just, number two we have is, I wanted to know if you need to mention the reasons for ordering the various diagnostic workups, and should I group them for diagnosis or just list them all together?
All right. Good question. So when it comes to your closure and you're outlining the differentials, you do want to list, of course, to the patient the workups you want to do. So whether you want to do, you know, x-ray, CT, whatever, some sort of imaging, whether you want to order labs, you know, whether you want to do any specific tests, you should just give them a general reason why. So for example, if we think it's a, let's say it's, we think it's a subarachnoid hemorrhage case. Yeah, I would say, so this is what we think it is, and we're going to order a few tests to confirm or rule out one of these differentials. So what I'd like to do is run a CT scan, which just takes a picture of your brain, get some blood so that I can see what's going on in your system, et cetera, and then maybe run this test, which does XYZ. So yeah, it's a good idea to just really quickly spit out the reason why, but don't get into the nitty gritty details of, yeah, we're gonna do a CT and this is how it works and we're gonna put you in a machine or we're gonna do this. Don't get into all that. Just say, we're gonna do a CT, which just takes a quick image of your brain. We're going to do a CT, which takes a quick image of your abdomen. We're going to draw some blood, take a look at, see what's going on. Maybe if it's anemia or you think hypothyroidism, we're going to check your thyroid levels. We're going to check your iron levels. Very, very quick and simple. Keep it as layman as possible. And then the other part of that question is grouping them per diagnosis or listing them all together. I would just say whatever you have outlined. For example, if you have migraine number one, let's say subarachnoid number two, for example, cluster number three, whatever, when you're writing your note, I would say, look at the differential and then ask yourself, what workups do I need to do to rule this in or out? And then just list them. It doesn't have to be in that order, but it's easier for you to group them that way just because you should not jump all around, but say, what do I need to rule in or out number one? What do I need to order to rule in or out number two and three, et cetera, et cetera. So it groups them together, but it's not like you have to do that. It's just a way to organize yourself. So that's what I would suggest.
Yeah, perfect. Doc. I mean, that's the same exact approach. That's you have to have this approach, or else you might lose points if you go too detailed. Because A, you lose time, and also the patient's like, I don't know what this guy's talking about. I have no idea what he's saying. He's just throwing out medical terminology. So
right, and sometimes what I've noticed is sometimes if you are maybe talking a little too medically, meaning using too much medical jargon, you know, students don't realize that in the CS, you can say things and your SP might not understand, but they're not going to say, hey guy, slow down. I don't understand what you're saying. They're just going to sit there blank faced and they're going to realize, oh, I'm docking him points for this, 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 and this. They're not going to necessarily point out all your flaws. So you have to be aware that you just can't do it, right?
Yeah, I agree.
A lot of times students will, who, you know, come to work with us and they'll say, you know, I did this and the SP just had a blank stare and I didn't know what to do. Okay, well, that's fine. You might have said something that he didn't understand and he was just sitting there waiting for you to say, you look a little confused. Did I say that in a way that was understandable or would you like me to restate it? So, you know, they're not just sitting there blankly staring at you for nothing. There's a reason, but you sort of have to go into it realizing that that could happen and to avoid these issues altogether so that you minimize the potential, you know, miscommunications that could come on.
Exactly. Just always bring everything up. Whatever you see, ask the patient, bring it up, because many times they're actually doing it because they're testing your observation skills. Are you seeing what they're doing? You're just focusing on your next set of sequencing questions. That's all.
Perfect. Number three. All right. Number three, is it okay to ask a few questions during the physical exam? For example, have you noticed any swelling in your feet while examining the feet?
Okay. So this kind of approach, I get this question asked quite a bit. Realistically, I personally would like to ask everything during the history encounter, but at the same time, if you feel that you forgot something or you forgot to ask a certain question to review systems, when you're doing the physical exam, you can ask anything your heart desires. Just remember though, if they give you something positive, you won't be able to write it down. That's why I advise to write it when you're asking questions, because you have the paper in front of you. Now, many times, people always ask me, they go, how about when I'm about to close a case, can I ask the questions? You can ask questions anytime you like throughout the whole encounter. But if you have a systematic approach, you keep track of what you ask, you'll never forget anything. Because I've seen doctors, when they train with me, they wash their hands, sanitize their hands, and they ask a question, and they go back and write down the information. That's a big no-no. Because now you contaminated your fingers, your hands, so to speak, because you touched the board again. Perhaps you don't go back and sanitize your hands again. So now you're hitting yourself left and right. So I would suggest to have everything asked in the history. And if you happen to forget, you could easily ask in your physical and or during the closure if needed. That's my approach.
Yeah, I agree. You need to have a system in place that makes sure you ask everything during the interview. That's the ideal scenario. Now, there's two caveats. If you forget one or two things and it pops up during the physical, go ahead and ask it. But make sure that it seems like it's just routine part of your physical exam. So you don't want to say something like, oh, Mr. Jones, I'm really sorry. I forgot to ask you this question during the interview, and then ask it. You don't want to do, you're pointing out your flaws. Don't do that. Keep it smooth. And the other thing is, if it's one or two, that's great. But if you forgot the entire social history and you start asking it, they're going to know better than to just think you're just, you know, spitballing questions. They're going to know that, oh, this guy forgot the entire second half of the interview, and you will lose points, right? You just can't. You have to be good enough that you're not forgetting massive chunks of information and questions and this or that. So keep that in mind. One or two, yes, but if it has to be done, smoothly integrated into the encounter. Number two, if there's too much, then you need to work on yourself. So make sure you see if these things are coming up during your practice. You don't want to get into your exam and then realize, oh man, my system's way out of whack. You want to make sure you identify these issues well before you actually take your exam.
You know what? The reason why we emphasize, ladies and gentlemen, is to do the review of systems. Because when you ask a patient questions and you happen to ask about lower leg swelling, edema, you don't use the word edema, you say lower leg swelling.
Yeah.
If they say yes, then on physical exam, you should try to observe it and say, Mr. Smith, earlier you mentioned to me you have swelling in your lower legs. Today, I don't see any lower leg swelling. Oh, well, today I'm better. So not only are you asking the right question earlier, but then you're showing to the patient that you remembered what they told you, and you're presenting it to them in the physical. that's another reason how you can get more points and build that rapport with the patient that's going to love you and really understand that you know your sequence. So that kind of scenario with throwing keys every time you go home. If you're a key thrower, you're going to lose your keys. If you go home every day, you put your same phone, the same keys, and the same part, you won't forget ever where you put your keys. Same thing with your sequencing. Know what you're asking, you'll not forget it.
Yeah, beautiful. All right, let's do number four. Go ahead.
All right, in the closure, how many differentials do we have to mention? And can we use medical terminology to tell them what they have? And then explain the terminology in layman's terms.
Okay, so I think what you're asking is, can I say to the doc, to the patient, I think you might have hypothyroidism, or I might think you might have anemia, and then sort of explain to them what that means. So for example, I think what this question is, so Mr. Jones, based on your signs and symptoms, I think we're dealing with one of two things, potentially hypothyroidism, which just means that your thyroid hormone isn't producing your thyroid gland isn't producing enough thyroid hormone, or anemia, meaning your iron levels are low. If that's what you're talking about, I don't see any issue with that. It's probably a great approach. Instead of just saying, I think you have one of two things, low thyroid hormone or low iron. Equally as good, but the other way, at least you sort of outline it in your head too, so that when you go and you write your differentials on your note, it's already there in your head. I don't see any problem with doing that whatsoever. Let's see, in the closure. And how many should you mention? I would mention the differentials that you plan on writing in your patient note. You don't want to go into your closure, list two things, and then have three differentials, or list three things and have two differentials. Keep it consistent. There's absolutely no reason why you sit down at the end and you close with your patient and you don't have the exact same differentials to them that you have on your note. Why would you have anything differently? Unless you are thinking additionally when you sit down, if that's the case, then means you're not properly getting through all the information you need to come up with a differential before you sit down for your closure, but you absolutely have to get yourself into that position. So list the same number in the closure as you are on the patient note.
And a quick tip for everyone out there, what you don't do is list them what they don't have. What I see many times students doing, which then causes issues with their timing and they can't close the case, is they'll say this, Mr. Jones, I asked you many questions. You presented with this. What I think you don't have is X, Y, and Z. And I'm saying to myself, why are you telling the patient what you're ruling out? Because at the same time, shouldn't you be telling the patient what they do have? Mm-hmm. If you have all the time in the world that you do in the hospital, take all the time you like. But every second counts on this exam. And don't fall into that trap of getting nervous and then just spitballing stuff, telling them what you ruled out. And then next thing you know, you don't have time to close. So.
Yeah, perfect tip. Awesome. All right, number five. If we hear the announcement at the end of the encounter while we're still examining the patient or while in the middle of closing, do we still have to excuse ourselves out, shake hands, and leave, or do we just leave?
Awesome. What you don't do is just leave, right? You always have to address the fact that time is out. Mr. Jones, Mr. Vanessa, I'm sorry, I have to leave the room or exit the room. There's an emergency or I'm being paged, one or the other, you have to mention. I will step out and come back in a little later. Very nice to meet you. Shake hands and leave the room. You don't want to stand up and just beeline to the door because that just shows not failure, but it's more like it's not a right thing to do, right? Yeah. That's the whole point. So to that effect, if you're sitting and closing and you hear the alert and you have to leave the room, you didn't fail. It's just you have to exit the room because everyone has to be exiting to type their notes because the patients have to grade you accordingly when you leave the room. So it's a very imperative not to stay in there because they'll pull you out. It's a violation if you still stay in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. I always recommend students also have a default go-to phraseology of whenever that happens, which you don't want it to, but it's sort of like, you know, if that worst case scenario happens, have something that you're going to say. For example, I'm really sorry, but I'm being paged. I have to go. I'm going to run some tests. And when I have those results, I'll get in touch with you. Shake hands and leave. 5 to 7 seconds of just wrapping it up, I think, is a perfect amount of time. I've been telling students to do that for years. No one's ever had an issue where they said, you know, that happened to them again and again and they failed. So I think there's nothing wrong with having that that default go-to phrase to tell your patients.
Yeah, just two things you don't. You just don't walk away and just show that defeated. That's all. Shake hands and leave. Always shake hands when you come in, when you leave. Please shake hands.
Yeah, you know, we teach our students that to operate within certain parameters so that they're essentially putting forward a perfect encounter. But things happen. Even the best of the best, sometimes, you know, you get a little sidetracked or a patient just asks way too many questions and things happen. Like, you're going to run out of time. It's possible. So prepare yourself so that that doesn't happen, but have a contingency plan in place so that if it does, you can go to that, right? Yeah. Have a contingency plan in place for when that patient starts to ask you silly, silly, challenging questions. You have an exact roll off your tongue contingency plan. So, you know, when they say something, this automatically comes out. When the timer goes off and you have to leave, this automatically comes out. And practice those things over and over so that when it happens, unfortunately, if it happens, hopefully it doesn't, but if it does, you know exactly what to say, and you, it looks like you're just rolling nice and smoothly with the punches.
Of course, perfect.
All right. Number six.
How much support should I put for the differentials? First aid has very few, but AMBOS has a lot. I don't know what to do.
Okay. So support, I always say put enough support that when someone is reading your note, if they don't have the opportunity to read the HPI and the physical exam, the support is sufficient for them to say, oh yeah, that makes sense. So for example, if you want to support a migraine, just saying headache is a little too vague. Nausea, vomiting is specific. Saying unilateral and extreme pain, like not 10 out of 10, is specific. But if you keep things general, that's not good enough. So I would say, don't worry necessarily about quantity of support. I would say work on quality of support. I need to look at each differential, and it needs to look from my perspective, like you understand 100% that this piece of support strongly points to differential number one. That's my approach. Now, keeping vague general pieces of support in there, it's okay, but that has to accompany strong specific support. So like I said, I want your support to be good enough for each differential that if I can't read the HPI to really get an understanding of what's going on, I still see that the support is there for each one, and there's no doubt in my mind that it is that differential. Does that all make sense?
Well, you know, and just to point out, long time ago, I mean, when we took our exams, there was no support needed with the list of differentials, and underneath was a workup. Now, for so many years now, you have to provide that evidence. Because I had a student send me a note once where he listed all three differentials, and underneath the support, it said, see above. So I'm like, see above? He wanted me to pinpoint exactly what he needed to be the support. So that just tells me more that you need to provide evidence and support why you chose one over two over three.
Yeah.
Simple as you do that, you get the points. You don't do that, you don't get the points.
Yeah. And so, yeah. Exactly, quality versus quantity every time. All right, question number seven. In the case of an abdominal exam, is it recommended not to repeat any painful maneuvers? So if the patient reports pain on palpation, should we avoid Rov-Sing rebound?
Okay.
And then they wrote something else, but it's incorrectly spelled, and I don't know what they're trying to say. So
when you go to the test center, there's an orientation video you have to watch beforehand. I would advise you to watch it, then they make you watch it again. At the same time, every test center will tell you, please do not palpate the patient too deeply because they're getting touched 12 times, right? 12 times in a day. So to take that into consideration. Now, when you do abdominal exam, always be cautious and careful. At the same time, I would palpate, but I would bring it up to them, say, Mr. Jones, Ms. Smith, I know you mentioned you have right lower quadrant pain. I will just touch lightly to see exactly where the pain is. Because remember, now you asked me about Rov-Sing, about rebound, about SOAS, about obturator. Those are special tests. If you can't do the special tests, you won't be able to actually get the answer to differentiate and support your appendicitis versus peritonitis. So always be cautious and careful. You can't assume anything. If you just go away and start palpating people without bringing it to their attention, they're going to fault you. So it's not repeating painful maneuvers because you're doing it once. Now, if you're pushing down on the right lower quadrant from McBurney's and you do it again and again, and you do Rov-Sing and you do SOAS, Well, the rule of thumb is if you get one positive finding for a special test, you're good to go. Don't keep repeating because you're actually making the patient continuously be in pain.
Yeah. So awesome. Yeah. The only thing I would add is one of my approaches is always make sure you're communicating with the patient on everything. So, you know, if it's an abdominal pain case, of course, you're going to have to examine the abdomen, but make sure that you ask them for permission. So at the very beginning, I need to examine your abdomen. I know you're in a lot of pain, but is it okay if I gently do this, do this, do this, and then get permission where they say yes. And if they say yes, great. Now you have permission to go forward. Then make sure you keep an eye on their face. Watch for grimacing. If at any point they look like they're in pain, say, I can see that you're in a little pain. Would you like me to stop or would you like me to continue? You can do anything you want in the CS, and you can really get away with anything you want, obviously within the rules of the exam. But as long as you're getting permission to do things and you're getting feedback from the patient and they're on board and they're saying, yeah, no, go ahead, that's okay, then you're going to be fine. If they're in a ton of pain and they say, that's okay, go ahead and do what you have to do, because you ask them and you explain to them why you need to check that area, if you get permission, they're not going to fault you. They might say, oh, I'm in pain afterwards. But as long as they said go ahead because you asked for permission, you're gold. There's nothing you can do that's going to cause you to lose points if you have that permission. So communication, constant communication is essential in situations like this.
I mean, I've been a patient twice with my back issues, and I can see more being a patient at the point of view. When a doctor walks in, starts moving my legs around without giving me a heads up, makes me feel uncomfortable, right? So let me know what you're doing to me. Same thing. Talk to your patients, especially in pain cases, like Dr. Paul mentioned. Pain cases, it's a go-to always. Every time they're owing, ooing, whatever kind of noise they're making, stop and address it. Don't continue asking your questions, because the patient says, well, I was in pain all day and this doctor wasn't caring to me, you know, he wasn't addressing my pain. So that's what you have to do. Always, every time they show pain, stop and continue addressing it and moving forward.
Yeah, and just let me throw one more thing in there. I just read an article, even today, lack of communication is the number one reason for patient complaints.
Sure.
So if you're communicating properly, you're in good shape. All right?
Sure.
All right. Sure. Go ahead. What's number 10?
We have a confused patient.
Oh, sorry, number 8. So if I have a question, number 8 is, if I have a question about a confused patient, how would they present confusion? Will they answer the history questions well? Thoughts?
Okay, so ideally, think about it. In reality, a confused patient, they would have their spouse with them. So on the CS, they're going to challenge you accordingly. So yes, they're going to show some confusion as far as how they're going to present. Well, they might not understand, or they might not know exactly where they're at. They might say that confusion more mainly with memory loss. So are they confused? My main question is, Mr. Jones, what do you mean by confusion? Tell me more about what are you confused about? Mm-hmm. Because they might turn around and say, well, I'm confused about where am I, and I forget familiar places. Boom, you're in memory loss. So you start thinking Alzheimer's, vascular dementia, you start thinking MPH, you start rolling off all the differentials. So clarify whether it's dizziness, whether it's confusion, whether it's winded. You have to ask these kind of questions to clarify with the patient what they're actually asking for. And then as far as what they're going to be confused about, I mean, you know, will they answer the history questions well? Maybe not. That's something we call time killer, right? They'll probably kill mainly your 15 minutes because you can't speed them up. You can't rev them forward. If you ask them a question, they'll say, I'm not sure yet. Or I'm still kind of confused. So prepare to be there for 14 plus minutes at least.
Yeah, and remember, if you don't finish a case because of a patient like this, if you don't get all the information, that's okay. They know what they're doing. They're testing you. They want to see how you react to these challenging situations, really. So if you keep asking questions and they're just not going to give you the information, that's okay. Make sure you document that, you know, you've asked the questions and the patient couldn't actually respond. Document that information, and then just keep moving forward. But the big thing with the confused patients, the patients with altered mental status, is don't get frustrated. If they ask you your name every 30 seconds for the entire encounter, just keep responding, keep giving it to them. Just don't let it flush you, don't let it confuse you, because that's going to be where it causes you to fail that encounter, okay?
And that's when you guys, when you walk in, if you're kind of confused about what the chief complaint is, because they might give you different chief complaints at the door, always ask a question before you go in. For example, cough, dry versus wet. You kind of want to know what's going on, because if you don't have that kind of question, you'll have 15 differentials in your head. So clarify before approaching. Simple as that.
All right.
Next one, Doc. If after I walk in and go confirm their name and they say a different name, what should I do?
Great question. I have a very simple fix for this. When I'm at the door and I take down the information, when I walk in, the first thing that I do is I repeat the patient's name out loud, but in a question format. So let's say you're meeting someone for the very first time and it's a blind date. You walk up and you think it's the person, and let's say their name is Frank. You'd say, Frank, with a question sort of tone to your voice. So if it's Mr. Jones, I open the door, smile, make eye contact, I say, Mr. Jones? And when you say it with that question tone, they'll say, yeah, hi, how are you? Or whatever they may say. But if you just walk in and say, hi, Mr. Jones, my name's so-and-so, if they're not Mr. Jones, which the USMLE has been known to throw this trick at you, then he could instantly turn and be like, well, my name's not Mr. Jones. Are you in the wrong room? Are you a bad doctor? So you want to just, the goal with the USMLE is eliminate the potential for any of these roadblocks to come up. So I'd walk into the room, Mr. Stavros, and if it's you, you'd be like, yeah. But if it's not, it'd be like, no, I'm Mr. Johnson. Oh, okay, well, the door has said Mr. Jones, but I'm here to help you, Mr. Johnson. It's nice to meet you. Smooth. Just do it that way. I think there's no problem. I'm interested to hear if you have a different approach, Dr. Stavros, but I think that's a great approach in my mind.
What I want to add is don't throw your nurse under the bus, because I do this, you know, we do this live and we do this live online when we do our assessments for our students, and we throw this at them once in a while. And then many responses like, oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Jones, you know, my nurse out there. No, you don't want to say that.
No.
I mean, I get it. You just don't want to. You just take the punch and keep moving. You know, but my question though is, Dr. Paul, what do you do with the vitals? Do you do the vitals again? Are the vitals the same for the patient? Because that was a question I had the other day.
I mean,
the name is different. Do we assume the vitals are different, or they're the same vitals, just different patient?
I mean, at this point, we don't really have the capability to answer that question, because the vitals are the vitals. You're not going to retake their vitals, because
please never take the vitals again.
Yeah, if we've got a patient who, let's say, on the door presenting with hypertension, tachycardia, whatever, and the name is, we just don't have an answer to that question. This is one of those instances. Now, maybe inside there's a second set of information. You can take a double check at that. Maybe it's correct with the correct name. Who knows? But under this situation, I assume that the name was just incorrectly put onto the door and move forward. This is one of those things where there's no good answer to that question. So I would just assume the vitals are as they are. I would change the name of my note. And then you can even document it on the patient note. If you're really, really worried, you could say, you know, 39-year-old Mr. Jones, but in brackets, you could put doorway name states Mr. Smith. You could even do that just to cover yourself if you're really worried. But to answer your question, there's no answer. I would just move forward with the information given.
And remember, never do vitals in the room. You have a thalamoscope, otoscope, that stuff you can do, but the blood pressure, because again, it's not that advanced that when you put the blood pressure cuff on my arm, it's going to be some electronic reading. It's going to be Stavros's blood pressure, not Mr. Jones. Same thing with pulse. They're not checking to see if you're going to get the exact pulse. They're checking to see if you're going to put your fingers where they should be, right? So that's the whole point. You do that, you're wasting your time, you're getting not valuable information, you're going to kill the whole case for you. Really well.
Yeah. Awesome.
Okay, last one, Doc.
Last one. All right. Number 10. I was wondering what we would do if we have a happily married patient. Do we always ask male, female, both, and go into sexually transmitted infections and condom use, or just move on?
I really love this question. I know there's different approaches. Somebody used to call me the Hurt Locker of CS, and I don't know if you've seen the movie out there. It's kind of like diffusing bombs. In the CS version, you don't want to open up any unnecessary doors, right? So unless you feel the person in front of you has some discharge, some symptoms which warrants them possibly having an STD. If they're married, I still feel the CS world, because it's a fantasy world, there's still monogamy and there's still love and there's no cheating behind the person besides each other. But to go further, because if you have a person who's married for 5, 10, 15 years, and you say, are you using condoms? And they say no, and you just default into your routine counseling, they'll say, Well, why do you counsel me? I'm married with my wife. Why would I use condoms? Is she cheating on me? Am I going to get a disease? So ideally for the CS, if they're married personally, I wouldn't go further than just obviously are they having a happy, healthy sex life, because that can warrant into erectile dysfunction issues with performance because of side effects of medication. If they're single, if they're dating, multiple sex partners, you know, within 1 year, always want to make sure they're practicing safe sex. The question, male, female, or both? Okay, and I want to see what Doc says after I throw my approach. I personally do not like that question, because in reality, you can ask whatever you want. You're like, men, women, or both. But there's a chance for a person to jump back and say, excuse me, I'm a male. I don't like men. You know, I like females. What are you trying to call me? So on and so forth. So to avoid this from arising and perhaps getting you nervous in the room and then killing your valuable time, there's a better way to ask to actually get the preference. Mr. Jones, what is your sexual preference? Let them tell you. Well, I like men. I like women. Another approach I like is, Mr. Jones, are you sexually active? Yes. With whom? That word whom will tell me my boyfriend, my girlfriend, my fiance, my partner, and then it gives you a little heads up of what the person is interested, men, women, or both. Instead of throwing it out there, sounding very cookie cutter, and then all of a sudden they say, I'm actually very offended because I love women. Next thing you know, you're in trouble because now you have to diffuse the situation. They're mad at you, and best of luck because we're not in the room with you. What are your thoughts, Doc?
Exactly.
I wish I could be a little headpiece.
Best of luck, we're not in the room with you. No, it's true. This is super, super common. And it's been happening for years. And we put out so much free content around this too. People just default. I think they default to that. It's one of those things where it's passed on from generation to generation. And they keep asking. 100% agree. The way I approach it is almost exactly the same. I say, are you, you know, obviously when you get into the sexual questions, you know, let them know that, you know, everything is confidential, of course. I would just say, you know, are you sexually active? If they say yes, I would say the same thing. With whom? And usually it's my wife, my boyfriend, my girlfriend. And then there's a little caveat to, I think the way I do it, it might be a little different. If they're a little older, like let's say they're 27 and up, and they say they're in a relationship, I say, are you monogamous? They say, yes, I leave it alone. If they're younger, for example, if they're, let's say, a high school student or, you know, in college, even like maybe between 17 to 23, where, you know, that's sort of more of a, not for everybody, but it is more of an experimental time. I would say, you know, are you in a relationship? Or I would say, you know, with whom? Whatever they say, I would typically say, are you monogamous? Are you both monogamous? And then just move on. Just because you want to make sure, because, you know, sometimes, you know, college, we've all been to college, so we know what happens, right? You want to just a little extra precaution in the younger age group. If you have to ask a couple extra questions, but just definitely don't do the whole male, female, or both. Just with whom, and then just, you know, make sure you dig a little bit deeper just to make sure. This is, of course, assuming that it's a sexual related case, urinary difficulties, whatever it may be. But yeah, that's just a little caveat, but I approach it the exact same way you do. Obviously we do because we teach together. But yeah, that's definitely the best way to approach it, because any other way, you're right. You're opening up these potential areas where the SB can come back and challenge you, challenging questions, challenging scenarios. And there's nothing worse that a student doesn't want to hear than, what are you saying? My spouse is cheating on me. Oh boy. Mm-hmm. Then that is not only a one line response, but you know, then you have to worry that you've offended them and that they're going to carry that forward into the encounter. You want to avoid that at all costs.
Well, and a lot of our students are from abroad. So with the culture, with their background, with where they live, you know, they're used to where they're from. Yeah. So in America, you know, if you're dating somebody, it doesn't mean that you're going to be committed. So meaning if I'm dating, maybe I'm dating for the past 2 months. Sure. Prior to that, in the past year, I've had 7 partners. So that's where you have to be careful, because with Dr. Paul and I, when we train students, we come up with these scenarios, because when you're doing it all the time, we find ways that we try to challenge our students, and then eventually it comes true on the exam, because there's only so many ways you can spin something. So that's why I always think, what can we do to get our students so they don't have any challenges on the actual exam day, right? So that's the whole point. Always ask, are you sexually active? Because sometimes they're a virgin. And if you say, okay, how many partners do you have in a year? Well, Mr. Doctor, I'm a virgin. And then as soon as when they get offended, then you might start cutting.
Yeah, so that's what. Really yeah, cautious. The vibe inside the room can change very quickly with sexual questions, so you have to be really careful. Actually, you know, just talking about this, it seems like there's probably a lot of things that we can unravel here. So I think in an upcoming episode, we should make it exclusively about how to tackle the sexual questions on the USMLE and how to handle challenging scenarios and challenging questions that might result from it. I think it's a good idea. And anyone who's watching or listening, if you think that's a good idea, you know, let us know, because I think that would be a great topic. Huge area of concern for students.
Yeah, it can make you definitely not feel great when you have a patient look at you weird. So that's why you have to make sure this doesn't occur. So I'm looking forward to that session.
Awesome, nice. Awesome. All right, so yeah, that was some of the 10 most common questions that we've been receiving. If you guys have questions you want us to answer, let us know. Follow us on Instagram. I'm at Dr. Paul USMLE. Dr. Stavros at Stavros VMD. I'll put these in the show notes as well. Don't forget to, you know, keep listening, subscribe, share with your friends so that everyone can get access to this training. And thank you all for stopping by. We'll see you on the next episode.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. If you found it to be helpful, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening from. And please leave us a 5-star rating while you're at it. The more reviews we get and the higher our rating, the more medical students we can reach and help throughout their journeys. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you know when our newest episodes become available, which are every Tuesday at 6 a.m. Also, for daily inspiration and med school and USMLE related training, be sure to follow both myself and Dr. Stavros on Instagram. You can find me at Dr. Paul USMLE, and you can find Dr. Stavros at Stavros VMD. I'll also leave those in the show notes for easier access. Every week, we give away free USMLE training, free CS assessments, and free memberships to our medical student mentorship program. For a chance to win, take a screenshot of the podcast and post it to Instagram, tagging myself and Dr. Stavros, and share it with at least one person who you believe would benefit from listening to the podcast. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you on the next episode.